Okay, so it's time for Pentateuch. And we're moving ahead in Exodus. We got partway through chapter 15. And actually, if you remember last time, we basically talked about Passover, and we got the children of Israel out, and they crossed the Red Sea and had the great big celebration, singing the song that Moses wrote. And that's something, I don't know if I commented, that from what I've read, Hebrew scholars say that the poetry of that song is excellent, that it's just really a really good song. So it's one of those things, I don't know that it comes across nearly so much in the English translation. I've always loved the song in our hymnal that we sing based on it. But and then, of course, the last thing I think we mentioned was there's a slight mention of Miriam, and it calls her the prophetess. And she led the women in this dance. And you don't hear much about prophetesses in the Bible, and not much about Miriam, but I did give a couple references to other places where it indicates that Miriam might well have had a larger role than anything we see or is described. And then from there, and without a chapter break, we go into a new episode. You know, starting in verse 22, Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea. They went out into the wilderness of Shur and spent 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And when they found water, it says they came to Marah and they couldn't drink it because the waters were bitter, and that's why it was called Marah. Marah, the Hebrew, means bitter. Which you could relate that to in the story of Ruth. Ruth's mother-in-law, you know, Naomi, said, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Marah, for the Lord has dealt bitterly with me." So variations of that name have come down through the ages, like in Celtic, Moira is around. And my wife, Susanna, is actually her middle name. Her first name is Myra. But anyways, that aside, the people, verse 24, complained to Moses saying, "What are we going to drink?" They said, "Okay, we got a problem." So he cried to the Lord. That's in verse 25. Moses goes to God and says, "Yeah, this is a problem." I will note here, God gives Moses instructions, but he does not reprimand Moses or Israel. Basically, he says, you know, he showed him a tree. When he cast it into the waters were made sweet. Okay, so there's a way to solve it. Now, it's worth noting, some people will say, "Oh, what kind of tree was it that can heal the waters?" I'm confident that the tree, or it's probably just a big branch. I doubt that he lugged, you know, a sycamore tree and threw it in. But it was symbolic. It was something to do to show the people that God was working a miracle. But I have no doubt that the changing the water's nature was something that God did miraculously. And then he makes the point that he can heal. It says he made a statute and ordinance there, for he tested him in verse 26. "If you diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments and keep all his statutes." Interesting, we could just note as an aside that this is before Mount Sinai. But God is referencing ordinance and statutes. He says, "If you do these things, I'll put none of the diseases on you which I've brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Lord who heals you." And that's presented many times as one of God's names or titles. Yahweh Rofika is the way I've mostly heard it pronounced and spelled. So it's something he could be known as. "I'm the God who heals you." And really, that's what it means. You could say God, the Lord God, healer, or who heals. I've seen some versions of it, but we would add to that, to me, I would make a reference to James 5, verses 14 and 15. Because God still promises to heal us, but there in James 5, he says, "If any one of you is sick, let him call for the elders, and they'll pray, anointing him with oil." I would add one other thing. You know, God does promise healing, but we'll see as we go through the law that he's going to show them health principles. Within the law that he gives to Israel is going to be principles guiding them in good hygiene and proper diet and quarantine to stop sickness from spreading. So at the same time, God will say, "Hey, I can heal you." It's one of those things where God can do things for us, but he also teaches us to do things for ourselves. And he'll do that with Israel. That makes sense? Yeah, in verse 27, they came to Elim where there were 12 wells of water and 70 palm trees. Probably it was a large oasis. Interesting that there's 7 or 12
well, so there's one for each of the tribes. But they're continuing their journey, so we'll continue. Not that I'm in a big rush today, but they journeyed from Elim, and all the congregation of the children of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. I've always wanted to laugh at that because, oh, that must be where they would sin a lot. But I don't believe sin there is meant to be an adjective. It's a proper name, probably related to Sinai, as in Mount Sinai. The first three letters of that is S-I-N. So this is just the name of the place. You know, it's not saying, it's not named because there's a whole lot of sinning that goes on. So they travel on, and at this point, they've been gone from Egypt, we think, about a month. And they brought some provisions with them. It's not described how much, but they packed up what they had, and we know they had unleavened bread. It said they didn't have time to leaven it. Maybe they've started making some that was leavened by then. But after all this time, it seems the provisions are running low. So they start complaining, as it says in verse 2. And they say, oh, we wish we died in the land of at the hand of the Lord in Egypt when we sat by the pots of meat and we ate bread to the full. You brought us in the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. Hunger will make people act irrationally. I wonder, though, when they say, you know, they're implying they would have preferred being enslaved to hunger. But then again, from what I've heard of dying by starvation, people will get to the point where they'll prefer anything to that. But it seems that their imagination now is making what was back in Egypt seem better than it probably was. I don't know if as slaves they were having pots full of meat and eating all the bread they could ever want. Now, I don't know, but there is not an indication that they ever went hungry in Egypt. So they did seem to have plenty. But they're upset. So the Lord gives an answer. The Lord said to Moses, behold, I'll rain bread from heaven for you. And the people will go out and gather a certain quota every day. But he's going to add that I'll test them, whether they'll walk in my law or not. And it'll be on the sixth day they'll prepare what they bring in, and it'll be twice as much as they gather daily. So it's funny, God is beginning to explain how he'll provide food, and it's going to reinforce the law of the Sabbath in particular, which we'll see will be one more proof that the Sabbath existed before God spoke it from Mount Sinai. I haven't heard anybody in this room expressing doubts about that before, but it's something we often comment on the church. The Sabbath didn't start when God spoke the Ten Commandments. It'd been around from creation. So he goes on, Moses and Aaron tell the children of Israel, at evening you'll know the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt. Then he's going to remind you with another miracle. And in the morning you'll see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your complaints against the Lord. What are we that you complain against us? Here's an important principle of government. Complaining against God's representative in one way is complaining against God. Now that doesn't mean God's representatives don't make mistakes and need to be corrected, because I'm living proof that they do. But still, you want to be careful about how we go about that. And verse 8, then Moses said, this shall be seen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and in the morning bread to the full. For the Lord hears your complaints which you make against us. And he says, what are we? Your complaints are not against us, but against the Lord. And that's reinforcing the point I just made. And the Lord spoke to Aaron, saying, say to the congregation of Israel, come near before the Lord, he's heard your complaints. Again, this shows that Aaron is still acting as spokesman. And it came to pass, as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the children of Israel, they looked towards the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. I sometimes wonder, what exactly did that mean? Did the pillar of cloud move over there? Possibly. But something happened where God got their attention to look out there, and strong indication that what was going to happen was indeed a miracle from him. Of course, he says, I've heard your complaints. I've heard the complaints of Israel, verse 12, say to them, at twilight you'll eat meat. So in the evening there would be meat, and we'll see that it'd be from quail, and in the morning you'll be filled with bread. Verse 13, so it was that quails came up at evening and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay around the camp. I'll mention that the quail was provided to give them actual flesh to eat. And there's some question, because not much is said about it here, but in Numbers 11, it's going to be a big deal, where they're complaining, we don't have any flesh to eat, give us, and we'll come to that account a little later where he sends them so much that it's like he says it's going to come out of your nose, you know, there'll be so much. And then some of them will eat it improperly and they would be punished for it. What we question, and I still struggle with the chronology, is did God send them quail starting now on a regular basis? And if so, why the big deal in Numbers 11? Or did he send it to them now, maybe once, and then later it becomes a regular thing? Or is this a reference to something that's going to start later? So there's these possibilities, and I'm not sure what's the case. You know, I sort of lean towards the idea that he sent them some quail at this point, along with the manna, and it might not have seemed very miraculous. Scholars say that this time of year was when quail would be migrating in the area. And I don't know much about quail, but I know certain times of the year I can look up and see clouds of birds flying. You know, one time of year they're all heading south, and later in the year they're coming back north. So it might be that the quail appeared and God did make it happen, but they weren't wowed saying, wow, what a miracle. Whereas what happens the next morning, that seems miraculous. We already read the dew lay on the ground. In verse 14, when the layer of dew lifted on the surface of the wilderness, there was a small round substance, as fine as the frost on the ground. So this, you know, maybe a lot of small little, you know, substances. And the children of Israel saw it and they said, what is it? They didn't know what it was. Manna said, or the Lord said, this is the bread that the Lord has given you. And the word manna is the Hebrew that means what is it? So they called it that because there was a what's that? Or, you know, I've heard some people say what's it? Or that type of thing. We're going to talk a little bit more about it, but I'll give you some references. Well, there's one in Psalm 78, verses 24 and 25. In one of the Psalms, it's referenced, and it's called their angel's food, which whenever I read that, I think of angel's food cake, which I really like, but I don't think that's what this was. And it's also worth noting, we're not sure if that was just some poetic device that the psalmist was using, because we know, as far as we know, angels don't need to eat. But we could say angels can eat at certain times, and reference back to the time in Genesis chapter 18 when Abraham had the one who became Christ and two angels, and they sat down and ate dinner. So maybe angels have eaten manna. At this point, you're saying, yeah. We don't much care about that. Maybe not, but I'm giving you the academic stuff. Worth considering also that manna did keep them alive. It was an amazing thing, and there's a symbolism. In John chapter 6, Christ would compare himself to manna, saying, yeah, that was bread that came from heaven, but it was still a physical thing, and he called himself the true bread from heaven. That's in John 6, verses 32 to 35. So we could take that to see that manna was a symbol of Christ in a certain way, in that it was life-sustaining. But it was life-sustaining in a physical way. Our relationship with Christ is life-sustaining in a spiritual way, which is what really matters. So we'll move on and cover, of course, the miracle, which we'll do after I turn the page. Here we go. This is the thing that Lord commanded. Let everyone gather it according to his needs, an omer for each person according to the number of persons. Some believe comes from the Hebrew amar, A-M-A-R, which can be translated to squeeze or to press down, which makes sense. If I'm out gathering food, I'm going to stuff in as much as I can. But it also might just be a literal formal name for a unit of measure. It's believed that an omer was about 3 quarts. And I say believed because the translation shows some difficulty. I know with ephahs, I've seen some things that say an ephah was about a bushel, and others say no, an ephah was half a bushel. And this isn't an ephah, I'm just using that as an example. It's an omer, whatever that is. Either way, it's showing that God provided plenty. They don't have to be precise in how much they gather. You can gather a bunch or a little. And it goes on to show, you know, he who gathered little didn't lack, and whoever gathered a lot still had just what he needed. But Moses said, don't leave any of it till morning. Notwithstanding, at least some people didn't listen to Moses, and in the morning they found it had worms and it stank. So God works a miracle in this. You can't keep it overnight. we'll also note in verse 21, they gathered it every morning, but they got to do it in the morning because when the sun comes up and gets hot, it melts and it's gone. So there are a number of miracles involved in this. Let's keep going. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread or manna, two omers for each person. And the rulers came and told Moses, he said, no, this is what the Lord said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath, a holy day. So bake what you'll bake today or boil it for yourselves. And, you know, so fix yourself food for today and save the rest for tomorrow. And they kept it and it didn't stink. It didn't get worms. And Moses said, this is verse 25, well, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath. You won't find it in the field. 6 days gather it, but on the seventh is the Sabbath and there will be none. Now, some people are a little stubborn on that. So some, in verse 27, went out on the seventh day. They didn't find any. And the Lord noticed. He said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments? See, this is verse 29. The Lord has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Every man remain in his place. You know, verse 30 says the people rested on the Sabbath. That was a lot, but I wanted to get through it and then back up and look at least two great miracles that God worked with this. Or at least two things to point out. One is he gave them enough manna for 1 day. And it's a miracle. I mean, it's there miraculously, but if you don't gather it up before the sun gets warm, it'll melt away. So the fact is God is teaching them that they are utterly dependent upon him. You know, he doesn't provide a week at a time or a month at a time. It's every day. Which reinforces the idea also that you have to do some kind of work for a living. It doesn't seem like it was real hard to go out and scoop this stuff up, but he didn't deliver it to their tents. You know, he didn't make it appear inside the tent. They had to go get it. And if they forgot to do it in the morning, they'd go hungry that day. So, you know, this reminds us, we could say spiritually, of our complete dependence on God. You know, and we refer to the Bible as being like God's Word. This is one of the examples where we say we should study, you know, the Bible every day. And I think of when Christ answered Satan, he said, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes out of the mouth of God. That's Matthew 4:4. I think that one's also Luke 4:4. That's one of those weird memory scriptures that's easy to remember two places. So anyways, the idea is, we need God's contact. We need sustenance from him daily and the way he made them rely on him daily. But then he worked a miracle, you know, so that, you know, 6 days of the week, you couldn't keep it overnight. But on Friday night, it would stay good for an extra day. So this was an absolute miracle once a week that happened. And he basically says, it's to prove whether or not you're going to obey me. And you could say it also proved to them when the Sabbath was. If there was any question going back to creation week and Adam and Eve, you know, have we lost track of when the Sabbath is? Well, it's reinforced right here. You know, it's a miracle that's going to go on, and it's going to go on for 40 years. Although it's not mentioned throughout the Pentateuch all the time, oh, every morning they have to go get manna. We know it does continue that way. Matter of fact, I'm looking for, Joshua 5, verses 11 and 12. And Joshua 5, 11 and 12 is where it says, when they entered the promised land and they could gather the corn or the grain of the land, the manna ceased. So it starts here and it's going to go for 40 years. You know, and the same miracle every day and the same miracle every week. I guess I probably said all I wanted to say about that. I will mention in verse 31, it says, the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like white coriander seed. The taste of it was like wafers made with honey. So apparently it tasted good. And although it's not described as much here, I know back over in verse 23, it said you could boil it or you could bake it. It seemed to be one of those foods that was pretty versatile. There are a number of things you could do with manna. Now, that doesn't mean they're not going to get bored with it, as we will see later, but I tend to think of potatoes. You think of all the different ways you can fix potatoes, right? Now, manna seems to be like that, perhaps even more so. What's another? I've been trying to rack my brain for another good example of a type of, you know, basic food source that you can do a lot of stuff with. Maybe corn. You can do a lot of stuff with corn. You know, manna's like that. And like I said, you could cook it a lot of ways. It's resourceful, or it tastes good. And my guess would be that God, like, vitamin fortified it, kind of the way you see breakfast cereal fortified with 8 essential vitamins and minerals. Because one thing they're not eating a lot of is salad. God provides manna. He's going to provide the quail, so they could basically get bread and meat. But they stay healthy all those years. So I'm guessing, you know, manna has all the vitamins and minerals you need, again, miraculously so. Because, you know, God doesn't put lettuce and carrots and all that other stuff out there that we need to eat. So we shouldn't look at this and say, oh, well, here's a great example. I'll just eat bread and that's all I'll ever need. Because if you do that, well, it won't turn out good for you in the long run, I'm pretty sure. You guys know that. Okay, let's note, God wants a memorial of this. In verse 32, Moses said, "This is the thing the Lord has commanded. Fill an omer with it to be kept for your generations, that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness." So Moses said to Aaron, "Take a pot, put an omer of manna in it, and lay it before the Lord." So they did this. They laid up before the testimony. In verse 35 is where it says, "They ate manna 40 years until they came to an inhabited land." And of course, as I mentioned, Joshua 5 describes that. Next to this, or in your margin, if you do chain reference, you'll want to note Hebrews 9 and verse 4. Hebrews 9, 4 is where it says that what they put it in was a golden pot. And I've wondered, did they put it in whatever they could find that morning and then later find something gold to put it in? The important thing is it's obvious that there is another miracle that God worked. Because if the manna out on the ground melts every day, and if you keep manna overnight, it has worms and it stinks, this particular pot was different. They kept it for hundreds of years, and it was okay. Now, eventually, it's going to go missing, because later we'll see a reference to the Ark of the Covenant, and it'll say there's nothing in it but the stone tablets. And so we wonder what happened to the other things that were there, like this golden pot of manna and Aaron's rod that budded, and we'll come to that later. So we don't know when it stopped being there, but at one point, this is set aside. This is a great memorial. The tabernacle is not built yet, but when we put the tabernacle together, this will go in it. You know, is it? Again, a memorial throughout all your generations. Boy, that was a long time on chapter 16, but I was going to ask you, are there any questions about manna, but I'd be surprised if there are. But Sky's ready to surprise me.
In practical Christianity, we were talking about like cooking on the Sabbath and stuff. So they boiled what they did before the Sabbath, right? And then they saved the rest of it. So then they were cooking it on the Sabbath, right? Then
seems to be, yeah. They weren't gathering it on the Sabbath, but cooking it on the Sabbath, it indicates that they did. So that's the way I would read it on verse 23. Bake what you will bake today, boil what you will boil, and all that remains kept till morning. So maybe on the Sabbath they baked or boiled whatever they had there, which, you know, seems to fit. And again, I mentioned, I'll point this out when we come to Leviticus 23, where I find an interesting turn of phrase that God uses, because he mentions not doing any servile work or customary work, or, you know, he makes a distinction, and then atonement is the one day where he phrases it differently and says no work. And I've often wondered, and it's still just a wondering, especially since I don't read Hebrew, that if the difference isn't because on atonement you don't have to cook and you don't have to wash dishes. But we'll leave that in the realm of speculation for now. Moving on to chapter 17. So we got this all done. The people have food. All the children of the congregation set out on their journey from the wilderness of Zin. I sometimes say Zin just because I don't want to say sin, because it makes me think of sinning. But according to the commandment, they camped at Rephidim, and there was no water to drink. And the people contended with Moses, saying, "Give us water." Moses says, "What do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Lord?" So, the people thirsted for water, and they complained against Moses. You know, "Why have you brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children with thirst?" Moses went to God. He said, "What am I going to do? They're about ready to stone me." So, reasonably so, you can go a lot longer without food than you can go without water. And there's a distinction. When they got to Marah, there was water, but it was bitter, indicating maybe you can drink it, but it'll make you feel sick, it doesn't taste good. Now there's no water, period. So it's bare, it's barren out there. So again, God doesn't chastise them. I think we can make the case that God will show them once that he's with them. He'll provide food. He'll provide water. Later on when they complain, then God will correct them and say, look, you should trust me by now. He doesn't say it in those words. Yeah, so the water is completely dry. They seem to wonder if God is really with them. It's in verse 7, towards the end of it. I'm jumping ahead and then I'll back up because he says, they tempted the Lord saying, is the Lord among us or not? So they were getting to this point saying, we're out here in the wilderness, there's no water, is God with us or not? It's kind of a shame that they were saying that because there's the pillar of cloud and it turns into a pillar of fire every night. And the manna is still showing up every morning. So it's not that they don't have ongoing miracles. But as I said, when you don't have any water, you know, you can get a little irate. So, of course, God gives Moses particular instructions in verse 5. Go stand before the people, take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river. So the same rod that he held, the river, that's the one he touched the Nile and it turned to blood. We would guess perhaps the same one that he stretched out when God divided the Red Sea. He said, and I'll stand before you there on the rock and you'll strike the rock and water will come out of it that the people may drink. And so they did. So there's a difference here from later in Numbers chapter 20. And there's two episodes where God is going to give them water out of a rock. Here he tells Moses, hit the rock. And Moses does and the water comes out. The second time he'll tell Moses to speak to the rock. And Moses has really hacked off the people, so then he hits the rock and gets in trouble for it. But this time there's no trouble. He's doing exactly what God says. And I'll just mention verse 7. He called the name of the place Massa and Meribah. Massa means temptation. Meribah means contention, which might well be printed in your margin depending on which edition of the Bible you have. So that's not some great esoteric knowledge. I'll tell you a speculation that I've read, and I don't remember where I first read it, partly because I don't give it much credence, but it's worth passing on so you can give it credence or not as you choose. But I've seen some people claim that there was a particular rock that Moses struck. And, you know, because we do see the, what's that word for the? Is it, I was going to say particle. That's not it. It's a article. Okay, I was close. I just put a P in there. The article the, like speak to the rock. Or later in Numbers 11, he says, or Numbers 20, speak to the rock. Here's, some people have speculated that this is the same rock that Jacob used for his headstone, and that later would be the stone of destiny on which the monarchs of Great Britain are crowned. And that's the very same one, and that they lugged it with them everywhere they went, and it kept giving them water. As I said, I think that seems really far-fetched, and part of me says, if it were that important, maybe Moses would have noted that. Here, to me, I tend to think that it's just a prominent rock, and yeah, he hits it and water comes out. But I'm sharing with you that I came across that. Yeah, Julie?
What did you say the word Meribah?
Meribah means contention. So there was temptation and contention, and they remembered it that way. At any rate, though, there's water. Yes, Emily?
How far apart are these like events happening? Is this all happening sort of all at once? Just because you have to wonder how they're already doubting things again.
Yeah, it is fairly short time, and we're not certain. I do know when we get to in verse chapter 19, it says the third month after the children of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt. So it's all within 3 months, and There is a common Jewish tradition says that the day that God spoke the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai was on the day of Pentecost. And okay, that's 50 days then from Passover. So, you know, the third month, it doesn't tell us which day in the third month we're at. But so this isn't spread out over years. So it is close enough together for, you know, people to seem to be falling short, questioning God. But the one thing I'll give them just to soften the blow a little, you know what you feel like after you fast a day or a bit longer. You know, you quickly start thinking, you know, a little awkward. Imagine you have no water and you're looking and there's no water, you know, for as far as you can see. I'm not saying it's okay. They should have trusted God, but that makes it a little more understandable to me that they might have jumped to some conclusions and said, look, is God with us or not? Okay. Something else happens here in chapter 17. Interesting story and a fun one kind of to speak of, maybe. Starting in verse 8, now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim. And this is not a guy named Amalek. It's people from the nation of Amalek. So it's worth noting, and that becomes obvious as we go. They came and fight. You might want to note Deuteronomy 25, verses 17 to 19. Because what it does not say here, but it does say in Deuteronomy 25, is that Amalek attacked stragglers in the rear of the camp. So as Israel's marching, Amalek not only, they don't come and confront them, they're trying to ambush and attack from behind. So it seems particularly cowardly in the way they did it. And that was Deuteronomy 25, verses 17 to 19. Do we know anything about Amalek? There was at one point a man named Amalek, and these are his descendants. Michelle's nodding her head. Do you remember who Amalek? I know because I've got it written down, so I'm not saying you all should know. Okay, Amalek was a descendant, I believe, a grandson of Esau. So Esau, Jacob's twin brother, Amalek is a descendant, and the nation of Amalek is yet one more of these group of nations that are related to each other. So there is this long ongoing contention. There will be contention between the nation of Edom and Israel. Amalek is described sometimes as a separate nation. I wonder if it's like a subset of Esau. It seems to be, or Edom. But at any rate, they're in that area, and the Edomites settled mostly around here. So we're not sure exactly where it is this happens. As I said, there's disagreement over whether Mount Sinai is here or somewhere over here. And I lean towards the over here, but the people from Amalek had to travel down, you know, to make the attack. At any rate, Moses says to Joshua, choose some men and go out and fight with Amalek, and tomorrow I'll stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So Joshua, we're going to become more acquainted with, and you're already pretty well acquainted with him because you started the year going through the book of Joshua. He's Moses' assistant, and he's also, now Moses is delegating the job of going out and being the military commander. While Moses is going to go publicly pray, Joshua did as Moses said to him. He fought with Amalek. Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And so it was, when Moses held up his hand, that Israel prevailed. And usually people say he had the rod in his hand, so he's praying aloud for God to give them victory. And keep in mind, you know, ancient warfare, you had, you know, people line up and they come in, and there's often what's called a killing zone where people come face to face. And people enter and leave that zone, so a battle can go on over time. Many of you have mentioned you've seen Braveheart, I think. You see the battles there where they come running together and there's just melee fighting, and, you know, can go on. And sometimes something like that would happen for a while. People would withdraw, regroup, and do it again. The thing I want to emphasize is this is going to spread out over much of the day. And we would guess Joshua is sort of in a leadership role. He's not out there swinging a sword. He's directing people. You guys attack over there, you know, come back, go over there, you know. So there's this the ebb and flow of the battle. And there's command and there's literal fighting and dying still going on. And we want to realize that, I want to emphasize the process of time, because in verse 11 it says, when Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. When he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. So God seems to be intervening to make a point here. And I believe very much that's the case. It's not just a coincidence. But Moses' hands become heavy. You guys ever done that test? I know men will tend to do this. I've done it. Like, how long can you hold your arm out? You're like, well, that's easy. And then after about 60 seconds go by, it starts getting harder. You get to 2 minutes, it's like, oh man, my arm weighs 1,000 pounds. So you imagine trying to pray and keep your arms up most of the day. Well, his arms got heavy. But when they go down, Amalek prevails. So he gets help. Aaron and Hur support his hands, one on one side and one on the other. And apparently they get a rock for him to lean against or sit on. So Moses is getting help. And that made his hand steady till the going down of the sun, so Joshua defeated Amalek. What lessons can we draw from this? I'm guessing there's some ones that should be pretty easy to derive. And if I open it up like this, I might hear some that I didn't come up with on myself. I mean, you could say, okay, if you want to win a battle, you got to have your arms up praying. But let's look for spiritual lessons. Andrew?
Endurance. To have endurance, to keep your arm up, to keep praying to God to deliver you from if you're going through a battle.
Okay, so I'm glad you, so not just physical endurance, but spiritual endurance. Anybody else? Think of some of the lesson with the manna. I said God provided it every day. That demonstrated something to them.
Reliance on God.
Yeah, complete reliance on God. And here, when Moses' arms are up praying, they're having victory. So he's showing reliance on God. Sky?
We need to be careful that if we, because we get the blessings of God every day, that it can become that we don't appreciate it as much.
Okay, so, you start taking it for granted.
Yeah.
So you don't continue to ask for them or show appreciation.
Allow others to help support you in community and work together.
Okay, yeah. So Moses couldn't do this on his own. He was relying on God, but God's only helping him when his arms are up. So, hey, guys, hold my arms up. So there's an important lesson physically that shows us something spiritually. Emily?
I would say also, like, it's a kind of a reflection of how if we obey God, then he keeps his promises.
Yeah, God.
But he does have stipulations, in Exodus 19:5, it's like, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant. Like,
absolutely, yeah. So it's not, okay, you get this, you got it. It's like, okay, follow through. Nate?
There's a training in leadership. Joshua, this would be a little side mission of his, and then he would be able to lead Israel later on.
Okay, so Joshua is escalating gradually in responsibility and leadership. Yeah, so and there's probably others, but the ones I wanted to point out especially is reliance on God, but also the need for support and help. Moses, you know, I could see God even doing this to humble Moses a little. Look, Moses, you don't have to try to do it all on your own. Keep that in mind as we go into the next chapter. So Moses needs help, and that's something we all want to realize. There are times when you need help. And I remember, it's funny, people referring to this story when I was younger, when Herbert Armstrong was still alive and he was out in the forefront doing the work. You know, he was producing TV programs and writing articles and meeting leaders. And he was the one doing those, but we talked about holding up his arms. You know, theoretically, because nobody had to hold up his arms unless Mr. Dean did at some point, which you never know. But, you know, providing the support for someone who's in a leadership role, and that's not just Mr. Armstrong, it's anyone everywhere. You're in a congregation, your pastor has a lot of responsibility, he needs people to help hold up his arms, you know, metaphorically speaking. And whenever we're in a leadership position or have a responsibility, it's good that you might need someone to help hold up your arms. So, anyways, obvious lesson, but I think it's worth bearing on. And guys, it also can make a great sermonette at times. And I've used it as parts of sermons before. So we're not done with the chapter yet. In verse 14, the Lord said to Moses, write this for a memorial in a book, and recount it in the hearing of Joshua. I cited this earlier as part of our five W's as evidence that, you know, Moses wrote this, and we believe he wrote a bunch of stuff. So he's writing in the book a scroll. So Moses maybe is in the process of writing down a lot of stuff. And God says, include this. In the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. So God's going to settle the score later with Amalek. And it will say, because they came and attacked stragglers in the rear. That comes up in Deuteronomy. You've read some account of God giving people opportunity to fulfill this. Remember the mission for King Saul? It's in 1 Samuel chapter 15. Samuel goes and says, God wants you to wipe out Amalek. So go wipe them all out. Hearkening back to this, when God said he would do it, what does Saul do? Goes and wipes out most of the people, but not the king. And they saved the best of the cattle and such. And that was part of Saul's downfall. I'll give you another reference that's more obscure. In 1 Chronicles chapter 4, verses 42 and 43, mentions the tribe of Simeon fighting against Amalek. But there's no indication that all of the Amalekites were totally wiped out. But there are some prophecies that I'm mentioning, in particular Obadiah. The book of Obadiah is a one-chapter book with a prophecy against Edom. And if Amalek is part of Edom, both Obadiah and some other prophecies indicate that at the end of the age, it seems like it's saying that all of the Edomites are going to get wiped out, that they won't survive into the millennium. And we'll touch on that in the prophets. That doesn't mean that they won't be resurrected like everyone else, but maybe eventually Amalek, as part of Edom, are going to be totally wiped out. And again, this isn't a great spiritual thing, but it shows this continuity through the Bible. When God, he tells all the way back with Moses and Joshua, I'm going to deal with Amalek, and we see it going forward hundreds of years. And perhaps it's still not done. And, you know, if that interpretation of the prophecies against Edom apply to Amalek, and Amalek hasn't yet been wiped out, perhaps God is yet to fulfill a promise that we're reading here in, you know, Exodus chapter 17. But if that's the case, we can be sure he's going to complete it. In verse 15, Moses built an altar, called it, "The Lord is my banner." Again, this is, in my margin, it has Yahweh Nissi, yet another name or title for God. The Yahweh Nissi, the Lord is my banner. And I point this out, you know, I've done studies where you can amass several names or slash titles that apply to God, that he goes by a numerous of them. Which is, you know, Lord my banner is just kind of cool. I think that sounds better than Yahweh Nissi, maybe because I know what this means. And he says, "For the Lord has said, I'll have war with Amalek from generation to generation." I'm pausing. We're ready to start a new chapter. It's not quite time for a break yet. Although some of you look like you could use one. Let me just introduce verse 18, because we're going to meet Jethro again. Verse 1, Jethro, the priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law. By the way, father-in-law, better take this with me, make sure I spell it correctly. I'm not going to spell out father. The Hebrew is Chothen, C-H, it might be Ho, you know how they have that clear your throat version, which literally means relative by marriage. And I say that to note that there's nothing that tells us that this is not Moses' father-in-law, meaning the father of Zipporah. But the Hebrew relative by marriage allows that it could be the original Jethro's son. This could be Moses' brother-in-law or cousin-in-law or something like that. But, you know, and there's no doctrinal difference one way or the other. One of the main reasons we bring it up is you don't have a lot of 80-year-old men whose father-in-laws are still alive. But since Moses is going to live another 40 years, who's to say that Jethro wasn't that old? Okay. Actually, I didn't get much further than that. Okay. Jethro, priest of Midian, Moses' father-in-law, heard of all that God had done for Moses and for Israel, his people, that the Lord had brought Israel out of Egypt. So he gets word because he's watching C-SPAN, and it comes up, and, oh, they're out. I got to go meet up with them. But somebody, yeah, it wouldn't be on C-SPAN. It'd be on, like, Fox News and NBC Tonight. C-SPAN's more boring than that. So we don't know how he gets word exactly, but he comes to meet him, and verse 2, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah. If I'd have just read verse 2, I would have got her name. Moses' wife, after he had sent her back with her two sons. The name of one was Gershom, for he said, I'm a stranger in a foreign land. The name of the other was Eleazar. The God of my father was my helper. So this reminds us of what? Anything come to mind? So Jethro's coming, hey, I'm bringing your wife and your two sons. Oh, it's a family reunion. I'm sure Moses is glad to see him. Yes, Andrew. Possibly, yeah. Remember that incident where Moses is first going to Egypt, and it says the Lord met him by the way at the encampment and sought to slay him, and Zipporah circumcises her son and throws the foreskin down and says, "You're a bloody husband," and we don't hear any more about it. Julia doesn't remember that at all. Where was that? I think it was in Exodus chapter 4. I want to give you guys the reference rather than... There we go. Exodus chapter 4, verses 24 to 26. So I want to hearken back because we haven't talked anything about Zipporah or the kids since then. So my personal speculation is that after that circumcision and the upset, she and the two boys go back to stay with Jethro, and they're there the whole time that Moses is confronting Pharaoh and turning water into blood and all that stuff, and now they're having a reunion. That's my guess, my first guess, but we can't prove that. It's possible that after that incident with the circumcision, they all continued to Egypt, and she's there with him for part of the time, maybe most of it. But at some point, here it says that he sent her back. So at some point, Zipporah and the two boys get out of Egypt and they're going ahead. You know, so the most likely time seems to be when they had that incident with the circumcision, but it might have been possibly later. And how much does it matter that we know exactly when? Almost not at all. So I'm just pointing it out because we question these things and we want to know what the Bible teaches, but also what it does not teach. So that's what we know. I will point out something else, though. Where was this here? Yeah, in verse 5, it says, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, came with his sons and his wife to Moses, where he was encamped at the mountain of God. Okay, Moses is already encamped at the mountain of Mount Sinai, so and Jethro comes to him. That tells us that this chapter might be slightly out of chronological order. The reason I point that out is in the beginning of verse 19, it describes them arriving at the mountain of God. So one chapter says they're there and Jethro shows up. The next chapter, they're arriving. Why would you separate and have this chapter, you know, describing something that happened later? Well, possibly because once you start the whole God speaking at Mount Sinai story, you don't want to interrupt it to talk about Jethro and the captains of 10, or possibly. So I'm just pointing that out because some people look and say, oh, the Bible, you can't trust it because it's out of order. Well, it could be out of order for a good reason, and it's only a little out of order. That, you guys follow me on that?